If you want to do innovation, you're going to have to create something new, something that's never been done before. How can you do that if you start with a set of processes that you already know the answer to or have a desired outcome? It's kind of like the idea, one of my favorite debates I used to have as Cree got bigger is people kept wanting me to focus on the best practices. And I keep saying, best practice? That's like the last idea. We want the next practice. So best practice is a flawed concept, right? It works great in a management-driven organization, but by definition, you can't be any better than what someone else has already done. And if you're pursuing innovation, something new and different, you can't go there. You have to think beyond that. And so I think there's this tension, and don't get me wrong, it is really important when you start to have a large publicly traded company or any large organization, management is a critical skill set. We hired a lot of people in the second half of my life at Cree that were great at management, and they made my life less stressful in many ways, being able to be more predictable and deliver those outcomes, because that's what our shareholders wanted. But it's different. And I come back to that first thing. It is, to me, innovation is not only people driven, but it's a leadership driven mindset versus a management one. And that's maybe a little too simplistic, but I really do think they're fundamentally different ideas, and people are wired to be more one than the other.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of the Go-Getters Podcast. So I had two amazing entrepreneurs stopping by the office back to back who have agreed to come on. We're going to have a nice conversation on innovation. So sitting across from me, I have Chuck Swoboda, who was the former CEO of Cree, the LED lighting company, and he took that company as CEO from a $6 million company to a $1.6 billion company. And in that time, he was named Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year in the Carolinas, and Cree was recognized by Forbes as one of America's 25 fastest growing tech companies in 2013. He's also a Marquette alum, very active with the university. Chuck, thanks for coming on.
That's great to be here.
And then next to me, we have Kelly Fitzsimmons, who is the author of the new book, Startuplandia, which you should check out. She's a serial entrepreneur. She's founded six companies, including Sunzu Security, Harquin, and Custom Reality Services, who just completed their Arthur Ashe production, Ashe 68, which has officially been selected for Sundance Film Festival in 2019. It opened up at Tribeca and is now up for an Emmy. Kelly also has an amazing story. She was once $5 million in debt at age 29, then came roaring back and got out of that at, I believe, 32. And she's also a good driver. My car broke down. She helped me get to the office the other week, and a Harvard MBA.
No, not an MBA.
A Harvard graduate.
I've got my master's. My official is comparative religion, focus archaeology.
Okay, so we're going to talk about innovation, and I just want to kind of open it up. How do companies do a great job of innovating, and where do companies fall short? You guys are very engulfed in this world.
Well, I'll take a shot at it, and then you can add to however you want, Kelly. My experience was really at one company, right? I spent 25 years at Cree, and our approach was very people-centric. And so I think that it was the idea was create an environment and get people to operate with a set of beliefs that allow them to then pursue these behaviors that make innovation possible. So what do I mean by that? So we wanted people that would take risk. We wanted people that didn't really think about, is they going to lose their job? It wasn't even part of their equation. We frankly wanted people that were more leaders than managers. It was really about creating an environment around people, putting them in a situation, and then they made that happen. It was, in many ways, it was kind of the anti-process.
What were some of the things? Because Cree, when you got there, it was a smaller company. By the time you were done, you had what,
7,000 employees.
7,000 employees. So how did you make sure to keep that culture and that environment growing from a small company to a massive corporate public company?
It was really easy in the beginning. It wasn't formal. It was essentially, I got there, I was not one of the founders, but the founders had kind of created this idea where they had these basic beliefs, and this is, they thought it was logical. So we just did certain things. So, you know, we had concepts like, hey, we're just going to say exactly what's on our mind, incredibly direct. We're going to, it's company first, and everything about we do. And we had a saying that was, everything decision we make, you should be able to prove to the, anyone that asks why it's in the best interest of the company's future success. And so it got people really focused. We had a lot of things like that. There was a, you know, you had nothing. So taking risk in the beginning is kind of easy. You either are going to take risk and figure it out, or you're going to go out of business. So you might as well take risk. So it's not very hard in the early days. As we got bigger, that changed a lot. So I'd say the first 10 years of that journey kept the culture pretty similar. Then we started to grow really fast. We had some years we grew 50% a year. And so if you're going to grow a company, a manufacturing company that fast, you're going to hire 30% new employees in a single year. So I think at one point we had over half our employees that had worked there 2 years or less. And so what you run into then is you have a culture problem, which is you have as many people that aren't part of your culture that are. And we struggled. And I think we made progress. We did lots of things to try to reinforce behaviors, the values, culture training. And eventually what I will tell you in all honesty is we got so big, we had to do things to manage the business that effectively made us less innovative by the end of it. And so I think this happens to many companies. If you, you know, I would tell you today, you know, people like to say, what are the great innovative companies? And one of them that's not is Apple. You know, Apple did some phenomenal things, but they're really a great management driven organization today. And I think those are the types of challenges that any company that goes through the maturity faces. Cause at some point your stakeholders actually prefer consistent results, quarterly earnings, no surprises, a lot more than, hey, I know we didn't quite hit the numbers this quarter, but there's this great thing coming next year. At some point, being a public company CEO, that it ages you quickly, turns your hair gray, and at some point, if you're not careful, it will get you fired. Luckily, it didn't in my case, but it does to a lot of innovative CEOs.
And you still have hair.
Yeah, I do.
Going on Apple, was their last great innovation the iPhone? And it's kind of just been a management organization since then. Because when a lot of people think of innovation, they do think of
Apple. I think it's the most well-known one. I think that really changed when you know, when Steve Jobs left and Tim Cook took over. He's done exactly what the shareholders want him to do. He's built a company that is more consistent with their products. He's done all the things a business actually gets rewarded for by their shareholders. It's much more consistently profitable. He's done a phenomenal job. But those same things is what stopped them from being able to do really big ideas. I think this is not to say one's better than the other. I think they're different. And my guess is if Steve Jobs would have lived a little bit longer, you would have seen him try some really big other ideas that may or may not have worked, but they would have tried them. And I don't think there's anything wrong with Steve. Tim Cook's approach, frankly, as an investor in Apple, he's done a phenomenal job. I think the point is they're two different things. And I think that we always confuse those two ideas.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, do you have anything to add on that? Or as someone who's started six companies, you've clearly have had to innovate in your career. What are some of the things that have made you so successful?
Well, I want to dovetail on what we were just talking about in terms of innovation in large business. And, you know, having been on the consulting side or on the board side of very large companies, I couldn't agree more. So my rule of thumb is I'm a creative person. And so I enjoy the creating and the founding part of startup life. When the company gets to, you know, going towards 10 million, it's too big for me. At that point, there's much more mature leadership that needs to be brought in. If I do stay on, which a lot of entrepreneurs do this, where they'll keep going with the company and try to grow with the company, I just create chaos. I love the new idea. I love the shiny object. I want to create something that nobody has seen before. And that is not the role of larger companies. And larger companies really struggle with innovation. It's just like it's almost antithetical to the culture on some level when you get to a certain point, because it's about processes and efficiency and good capital management. And when you're in the throes of new idea making, really a startup is just a business that is actively in the pursuit of going out of business until it figures out its business model. you know, once you figure out the business model and you have a product market fit, well, now you've got a real company that's actually a business. It's no longer a startup. And then innovation gets really, really hard because your investors are, they want you to turn the crank. They want you to make more money. And they want the repetition. And as an investor on the other side, you know, I agree with that. But as a human being, that's not where I play in terms of the ecosystem.
So what do you tell companies when you go in and consult on the board level?
Wow, I just did this week. You know, so much about is containment, trying to create, you know, almost you want to create a startup within and then not touch it. How do you, I've seen it with a couple other companies I've worked with where they had a dev team of less than 100. And this is a Fortune 500 company where they hid them in the mountains of Colorado and they had totally different branding. They had no real connection to the mothership. They're like, okay, you guys just go and figure this out. And this was in the voice space. And unfortunately, it didn't work because it, you know, by the time they got their stuff, and quite frankly, a lot of it was incredibly innovative, the market wasn't ready. And so much of that product market fit is when is the market ready for your innovation? And I tend to run 7 to 10 years early. And so my part of the startup sort of ecosystem is just staying in business long enough for everybody else to go, oh my gosh, that's genius. But I spend about 7 years of basically spiraling into self-doubt, wondering if I'm crazy, you know, slogging through meetings where people are like, I just don't see the value in this. And that's a very different personality type and type of company to run. It's also very painful, but I don't know. I seem to like it.
I think what she's getting at is, it, you know, it's as, you can summarize it as simply as, for anyone who's ever read Clay Christensen's book, when he describes the innovator's dilemma, when I first read that, we were a small company. And what he's describing is a set of a large organization is built around people and processes and in these management behaviors. And it's, the whole system is built to do one thing. And I think he makes a comment or something to the effect is he says the best managed companies are the worst at innovation because they're designed to do everything to protect what they have and expand it. And it's just, it's not about that problem. So it's really two fundamentally different problems. What you find is as Cree got larger and we wanted to solve those problems, we attracted different kinds of people. And so even though the ones that had helped us build it the first time were still there, the odds shifted. And once you get too many people on one side, that's the way the company's going to shift. And so I think, you know, you face that. We actually, to your comment about the secret project, we actually did it. So, we were, in 2012, someone came to me with the first prototype of the Cree LED light bulb. And now at this time, we had said we were never going to make a light bulb, and we really were not. Our intent was to make the LED, sell it to the light bulb companies, and we spent several years trying to help the light bulb companies do this. And we would actually invent LEDs faster than they could finish their qualification process. So these companies were following all the best processes. If I heard the word Six Sigma one more time, I would have gone crazy. But what happened was they literally couldn't finish. And so finally, one of our scientists who was told we're not working on this shows up in my office with the prototype anyways and says, I know you said not to work on it, but we can't wait. And so we decided we were going to commercialize it. And I was so worried that Cree, a company that was built on innovation, was going to kill it. They went off, five people, a warehouse, and they did finish the development, built the whole production line, did all the marketing. And I think the day we launched, we had about 6,000 or 7,000 employees. The day we launched, only 10 or 15 people in the whole company knew we had developed it, and we were in the stores. And because that was the only way to create that environment that she's describing, it just, you can't, they're two different things. So I do think that concept can exist. But I would say that if a large company was trying to do it with people that were good at working in the large company, I think it would be really hard. The people we put in that offsite location had been there a while. They were all our really entrepreneurial, innovative thinkers, and they kind of didn't like the bigger company anyway. So I think it's not just going offsite. It's p- picking the right kind of people. So Kelly would be phenomenal to go put in that offsite location. So she described, I don't want to do that other stuff. They didn't have to. And I think that's the, I think that's one of the challenges that, you know, as I sit on boards of other companies and go consult with them, I think they're confused. They want to do it, but I don't think they realize those people might exist, but they're probably different than the people you were thinking of. Is that a way to?
So perfect. I think, you know, people like me get rejected like viruses from large companies. You know, we can't handle it. The structure, the requirements to really be successful within a traditional business. So many entrepreneurs that fall into the category of startup CEOs and startup founders like me, we're unemployable. I mean, that's truly, that's really what it's about. We have to do our own thing because the big guys really don't know what to do with us. And so to your point, I think the key thing that gets goofed up is it's like, let's put the really smart, bright people on this startup innovation project. Well, they might be great in an Ivy Tower. They might be great in academia or in a large company, but they're not entrepreneurial thinkers. And it's not something that you can train people into. It's a type of like neurological flexibility and adaptation that we do, where we're just cycling through ideas constantly, and we can't help ourselves. We had a situation actually at one of my companies where our core product was failing, and my CTO snuck off and built the lifeboat. And so when it was clear that the business model was not ever going to pan out in this one direction, he showed up and went, ta-da! And it saved the company. I was madder than hell at him because he'd completely gone off, you know, and done this. But at the same time, you know, he was right. He saw it. And I, at that time, me, who I like to think I'm so innovative, I was so focused on the fundraise and the investor relations and making sure that we actually met our promises that I lost sight of the larger problem, which was there was no market. So that personality type does not tend to be happy in large business, and large business tends to not be happy with them.
Yeah. So what we did is when we were building the company and trying to scale it. So, you know, it's pretty rare for someone to stick around from the journey from 6 to 1.6 billion. And I think my interest is I definitely liked the early days. They were more fun. I was attracted to the challenge of trying to scale a startup. So my goal, I took over a CEO when we had a couple hundred million in sales, and my goal was to build a $1 billion startup. How could we run it the same way we had gotten to 200 million? And we got there, and it was pretty close. It was starting to change. And then my goal was to get to 2. And somewhere around 1.5, 1.6, when we got up to those numbers, it's the startup or entrepreneurial or innovation mentality started to make things really unpredictable. And we were good enough through the first billion to convince the investors to ride with us on that wild ride, but not on the second one. But what we did is in that early days of scaling, when we looked for employees, we frankly looked for people that had quit big companies. If they had worked there, that was okay. But if they were happy in a big company, we didn't want to hire them. And there's nothing wrong. Big companies are very valuable, value-creating places. I mean, it'd be cool to work for Apple today, but it's a bigger company, right? I wanted the person that got frustrated with those other pieces because they knew enough about what a big company looked like, but they were frustrated. And I figured that was a kind of a way for us to select who could kind of get us down that path. And it was imperfect, but it was a pretty good way to, you know, low-tech judge of who might be ready for that journey.
I can't. Oh wow! I love that so much. I haven't heard that approach before, but now you've really reframed something important for me. I love that because so many of our big clients, the rule was 3, 7, and 12. So who blew out in 3 years? Who blew out in 7 years? And who blew out in 12 years? And you wanted the 3 year, and the 7 year was pretty okay, but you didn't want the 12 year because they were already institutionalized.
Yeah, we actually had a rule that there were several large companies that we essentially for the first 10 years had a rule we would not hire someone from there. Mm-hmm. And by the way, these were some of the brightest people out there. But what they their approach to doing it and their what they had been trained and what they had believed was the right way to do it, it just didn't fit in our system. And so I want to be really clear. This is not there's a right and a wrong answer. There's a correct There is aligning someone's skills and their behaviors and their beliefs to the problem you're trying to solve. They're different problems. And I think too often this conversation gets lost in a one's better than the other. They're not better or worse. They're different. It'd be like trying to take, you know, it's like using the wrong tool for the job. If you need to screw something in, you don't pull out a hammer. It's that simple. And I think we don't think about people that way enough.
Yeah, we don't think about mindset. Right? I mean, that's not part of the hiring criteria. We want to know that they have these skills and, oh, they've worked for GE and or whatever, you know, this company. Okay, they've got a good training program, good leadership program. And so that's kind of how we check those boxes, right? But it isn't actually about that. Innovation is about a mindset. It's about a growth mindset. And it's actually a pretty rare thing to see in people. This is based on the idea of Carol Dweck. She wrote a book called Mindset, you know, several decades ago that was really a game changer in terms of understanding how people succeed. And it really comes down to how they view the world around them. Do they believe fundamentally that their intelligence is finite? If so, they are going to do everything to prove that they're the smartest person in the room. And from an innovation standpoint, that is a killer. You have to be able to park your ego and, you know, throw out stupid ideas. You got to be able to see what, you know, see what sticks, be able to give it up really quickly, argue the other side very quickly. And that kind of flexibility of mind requires that you fundamentally believe that, you know, intelligence is only gained over time through iteration, that, you know, we have neurogenesis and we do get smarter and we do have capabilities that we don't know about. We just have to keep that curiosity and wonderment and keep it at the forefront opposed to ego protection. And a lot of folks who do go into larger companies, ego protection is pretty high on the safety checklist, right? It's like, you know, oh, I look important. I've got this big title. I've got this, you know, group of people who report into me. And that can be, that just that mindset piece isn't something we interview for. It's not something, well, some companies do, but the vast majority of us don't even know what we're looking for when we're asking to hire people in innovation, and we're always looking for people with a growth mindset.
Hey everyone, it's Richie Burke, your host of The Go-Getters and founder of GGMM. Since you're listening to this episode, you clearly understand the power of podcasting, yet a lot of brands have yet to take advantage of this medium. Based off the success of our podcast, we recently launched GGMM's podcasting content service, where we're currently helping brands like On Milwaukee, Trek Bicycle, Collier's, and more not only create audio and podcasting content, but also take that content and turn it into engaging video and written content to use across platforms. So if you're looking to better communicate with your employees internally or your consumers, and are interested in learning more and think you're a good fit, just head to ggmm.io, ggmm.io. Thanks for tuning in. Let's get back to the show. What is the best way to hire people for innovation? Because there's a lot of studies out there that, you know, the interview process has zero correlation with the job performance. Should they be doing more personality trait tests? I like your thoughts about we reject people who have been in corporate companies too long. You know, are there other guidelines companies should use?
So I think you have to really decide if you truly want to pursue innovation. And I think that, and I'll answer your question, but I think most companies talk about innovation, but they really, I'm not sure, have made the decision that they want to do what this takes and what this looks like. It's an incredibly different approach. And so I just hedge that because I think as other people listen to this, it sounds nice. But it starts with the organization having a true belief and commitment that they're prepared to take all the good and all the bad that come together with this. It's not a one thing. And so I would just say that to me, hiring the right people, if you don't have that context to start with, there's no point. But so how do you go about it? So I give you a couple of interesting anecdotes. So I stopped reading resumes. I haven't read other than to typically look for someone's background to find something I could ask them personally, or I wanted to try to find if someone had worked for a company that I knew of that I could ask them a question about. And what I often wanted to know was, almost every company has a time in their life where something didn't go well. And I remember interviewing someone, I think they had worked at Sony. And I just said, so Sony, you know, you were there and you had this role. And I said, so you were, what was your role? And they described it to me. And I said, so, you know, it used to be like the best brand in TVs and it's not anymore. And what happened? And as they described it, I said, okay, so why didn't you fix it? And they looked at me like, what do you mean? I said, well, it's your fault. And they're like, how can it be my fault? They said, well, you worked there. They paid you to make the company successful and it didn't. And I knew it wasn't their fault per se. But what you're getting at there is that's what it feels like. You need someone in an innovation environment. There's this level of responsibility and accountability that, yeah, okay, I should have done something about it. And so it's an imperfect idea. And the last one you said something about title. So for many years, I ended the conversation. And typically, I wasn't just hiring people that work for me, but my team would say, hey, would you meet this person? And it was a combination, put the big sale on, we're going to be this great company someday, it could be really great, and see what you think. And I would always end it, I said, look, so tell me about the role you're interviewing for. What's the title you're looking for? And anyone who cared about their title, we did not hire. If title mattered at all, it doesn't mean they were a bad person. I just knew it wasn't going to work in our company. And so there are many, if you get people to talk about things other than their job per se, how they think, how they act, they'll give you a bunch of clues of what would fit or not. And I think it actually can be done. We did it for many, many years. It's not perfect, but honestly, it's far closer to getting to the answer than I think people give it credit for, but you kind of need to throw out most of the other stuff. And I had a coach that was a psychologist when he wasn't writing really great books. And if I really wanted to know, I'd let him meet with someone. And I don't think he'd talk to him for 2 hours. He would never ask them about their career. And he had the ability to tell me they'll fit or they won't every time. And it was all about who they were. And I think you can get that.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. I love this conversation. Assessments are really important to me, but not in the sense of the traditional assessments. So one of the things that I do use a lot is StrengthFinder, which is Gallup Poll International put together basically a system looking at talents. This is the innate way we think. And they had a sample size of over 2 million people whom they asked open-ended questions to help discern these styles of thinking. And there's 34 of them, and your likelihood of having the same top five as anyone, I think, is 1 in 33 million. So it's pretty unique. And what I found over time is by focusing on and asking everyone that I met with to do the StrengthFinder, I could really start to see a window into how they could be really successful. And how they could be really successful a lot of times was not in my company. The things that I was looking for were talents around strategy and ideation, particularly when we're talking in a innovation standpoint, right? Like who are going to be able to really see the forest through the trees? You know, there was other ones where I knew was totally antithetical to our culture. One of the strengths is harmony, really ensuring that people get along well. And it tends to have this inverse quality of not liking conflict. And great ideas often are born out of conflict. You know, you really have to ground them. One of my top notes, mine is positivity. It's great for entrepreneurship because I can always find the upside in any horrible, horrible situation. But it also can mean I'm untethered, that I can get really ahead. That's why I'm so early. I'm like, this is right around the corner, guys. This is going to hit tomorrow. Information security. It is it. And it's 1996, right? People haven't even decided that the internet is a thing yet. And I'm talking about firewalls. I mean, that's the sort of story of my career. And so being able to speak to not people's weaknesses, but what really, if they concentrated on these strengths and talents, they could have like a real virtuoso performance. I so believe in looking for the best in people and how do you grow that? But for me, there was very key talents that I really keyed into around innovation, that were a requirement. And others that, even though they're wonderful talents to have, were just antithetical to our culture.
Well, while we're on the topic of people, Chuck, can you touch on, we talked about this before we got on air, the difference between leaders and managers?
Sure. So, so one of the things as I've been in my retirement getting to think about this problem a lot more is I think the conversation came up is I get frustrated by how a lot of people try to give you the recipe for innovation, right? And here's a process to follow. And I think the idea is so many people want that, and I understand the desire for it. And when it comes out, when I look at it, what I see is I call it management thinking. And so if you think of its premise, right, management is about getting a group of people to follow a known process or set of steps to give you a predictable outcome. That's essentially the essence of what management is. And if you look it up in the dictionary, you're going to get an answer something like that. Leadership is about, I think the best I've ever heard it put is getting a group of people to do something that they otherwise wouldn't even think is possible. If you want to do innovation, you're going to have to create something new, something that's never been done before. How can you do that if you start with a set of processes that you already know the answer to or have a desired outcome? It's kind of like the idea, one of my favorite debates I used to have as Cree got bigger is people kept wanting me to focus on the best practices. And I keep saying, best practice? That's like the last idea. We want the next practice. So best practice is a flawed concept, right? It works great in a management-driven organization, but by definition, you can't be any better than what someone else has already done. And if you're pursuing innovation, something new and different, you can't go there. You have to think beyond that. And so I think there's this tension, and don't get me wrong, it is really important when you start to have a large publicly traded company or any large organization. Management is a critical skill set. We hired a lot of people in the second half of my life at Cree that were great at management, and they made my life less stressful in many ways, being able to be more predictable and deliver those outcomes, because that's what our shareholders wanted. But it's different. And I come back to that first thing. It is, to me, innovation is not only people driven, but it's a leadership driven mindset versus a management one. And that's maybe a little too simplistic, but I really do think they're fundamentally different ideas, and people are wired to be more one than the other.
So I guess one thing to end on, this has been great. Any advice for an entrepreneur starting out that is looking to innovate? One piece of advice to an entrepreneur starting out looking to innovate?
Oh gosh. Well, if you're looking to innovate, you might have the wrong perspective. So oftentimes I'll see entrepreneurs looking for an idea. They love the idea of being an entrepreneur, but they're looking for the idea. And I'm like, God, this is probably not for you. You know, you're an entrepreneur when you can't get it out of your head. You can't sleep. You've got that idea that you're just completely riveted by, and that somehow it lines up with either your expertise or passion, but there's a part of your core being that just needs to see this manifest. It's so hard, and the likelihood of success is so low in the early days to do anything where you're like looking or trying to think of an idea. It's backwards. The idea should be so obvious to you. That it's a hurt, it's a pain, it's a problem that you have that you've been actively working around and trying to solve, not just for the last couple of weeks, but, you know, for me, I think the average of me kicking around an idea is about 3 years before I start. There's no first, what am I going to do next? It's so obvious. I call it, what is your, you know, finding your mountain and, you know, knowing what mountain you want to climb. And I think today with teaching entrepreneurship in college and stuff, we're using institutions and institutional style learning to teach something that is anti-institutional. And it doesn't work. And the people who really thrive in academia very rarely thrive in this environment, particularly the early stage stuff. It's very messy. And it tests you on a lot of levels. And the true secret to it, I think this is my pet theory, is that people who have really difficult childhood, you know, situations where they're just, you know, they have to do something other than stay at home. They got to figure it out. Like, they got to make money, or they've got their side gigs, or they got their side hustles at school, whatever it is. These are the kids that are showing it. And I know this is in your story too, Richie, where, you know, you kind of are compelled to do something and create something. And it's never about coming up with the cool idea. It's like you're already doing it before you realize it's a business. And so there's part of this desire to teach entrepreneurship within institutions that is just, to your point about leadership versus management, it's fundamentally flawed.
Wow, that is awesome answer. That is, you're having me thinking, and I'm trying to imagine where I go with that. So a couple things. I would, to play off her idea, I don't think there's one piece of advice. I think it's a really tough question. So one of the ideas, I think you come up with these ideas and you're not sure which the right one is, right? And so I think you have to have these ideas. You see a problem that needs to be solved. People that are good at this, they can see problems, right? And they have this desire, I would take your words, they want to go solve it. There's some passion, and whether it be in your case, I think it was information security use. This is a problem. We should go solve this. But then the key is there's lots of those. So which ones are the right ones? And what I would tell you is I think successful entrepreneurs, two things. They don't care that they don't know exactly. The word I like to use is they embrace the concept of being directionally correct. So it doesn't matter if it's exactly this idea, because you know you're going to go try something and that new information is going to give you more information and then you can adjust and go forward. So in other words, they don't need to know the end point to start on the journey. And they know that by just moving in that direction, each new piece of information helps them along. I think the other thing that at least we saw at Cree is some of our biggest ideas, the most successful innovations commercially, were ideas that other people told us either we couldn't do or weren't possible. So what's happening is if you can find the experts in the industry, so in our case, there's no reason to ever make LED lighting. What we have is good enough. That was really said by three lighting company CEOs to me back to back to back at a conference many, many years ago.
That were much bigger than you at the time too, right?
Oh, by about, we were basically a rounding error in probably their monthly sales. I mean, these were the three largest lighting companies in the world and all said, the technology we have is good enough. By them telling us not only we shouldn't do it, but we couldn't do it. There's hints every time. And it happened to us. I have, several other examples along the way. Other large players tell you what can't be done. That's a clue. If you see a problem and they're saying it can't be done, they're actually giving you an idea about where the market is. And I think that's the trick to this, right? It's not just the idea, but to your point, where is there a market? They've told you. And so I think there's a little bit there too. One, you don't need to know exactly where we end up, directionally correct, but then I like to say, do what they say you can't. And I think those are maybe two places to start, but it's way more complicated than that, but at least that would be a fun place to start the conversation.
That is so on. I'm just smiling ear to ear. The idea of being directionally correct, couldn't agree more. It's not about the very specific idea, because that's going to iterate and change. And it goes back to that idea of being adaptable, like being able to see, okay, that didn't work. They're not ready for this, but what about this? What about this? I really want to key into the idea of, it is, the clues are out there and there's blind spots. Every company has a major blind spot. The customers are asking for something and the idea that it can't be done is this blind spot. It's just a sign where they're not willing to look because they're in the business of maximizing their current business model. And yes, in their current business model, this does not make sense. However, it doesn't mean that the market isn't there. The market might be absolutely there, but they're not able to pivot because they're this huge monolithic, battleship. And the only advantage we have as small startups is we're like a little speedboat. We can go check that out and see if there's anything on that island while they're just like, let it be.
Thanks so much for coming on.
It's been a pleasure.
You guys were great.
Thank you.
Yeah. And if you guys like this episode, make sure to subscribe, write a review on iTunes. That helps us out. We really appreciate it. And just a reminder, this podcast is brought to you by Go Get It Marketing and Media, ggmm.io, and our friends over at On Milwaukee.